Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and today I'm very happy to say that we have Cy Hirsch on the phone, and we'll be talking about his terrific memoir, Reporter. I should say that Cy played an interesting role in my life, though he didn't know it. I read his book, Mealy 4, while I think I was in detention, Cy, in my high school library in 1978, because I wasn't a very good boy. And it sparked a kind of lifelong interest in history, and I eventually became a historian, believe it or not, and I even wrote a book about Mealy. So there you have it, the power of good reporting. So welcome to the show, Cy.
I'm glad to be here.
Great.
And by the way, you're not the first story like that I've heard.
I bet not. Yeah, no.
The most touching one came from somebody who was at West Point.
Oh, really?
First or second year, and when he said, I can't be in an army that does this. And what they did is he gave up his commission, and he had to serve 3 years as a medic in Vietnam, or 2 years as a medic.
Wow.
Yeah, they punished him for quitting.
Yeah.
I mean, that's okay. Yeah. He did something useful.
He did do something useful.
Yes. Yes, and I know your book.
Pardon me for saying this, but and this is just so the listeners know what we're doing. You're kind of a famous guy, and pretty much everybody, at least in the chattering classes, kind of knows who you are. But I don't think they know much about you before you broke the Mealy story in 1969. So in the interview, I think that we're going to do is concentrate on the Cy Hirsch before 1969, if that's okay. And I'm really interested in how you became a reporter and if you don't mind these words, tenacious, independent-minded one. So I want to begin with the word reporter. You call your book Reporter, not journalist or investigative reporter. So why did you call the book Reporter?
Well, I think every reporter is an investigative reporter. I mean, unfortunately, they're not. But I think, what drives me crazy is we're in this sort of a very funny period of our journalism where there's no middle ground anymore. You're either for Trump or you're against Trump, and the media's gone all in on it. There's no one newspaper one can look to for an objective assessment of what's going on. You either hate Trump or you like Trump. And so it drives the way it works. But my thought, or even before this particular issue, which is exasperated something that's been going on for a long time, because the newspaper business doesn't have the funds it used to have. There's not enough money. There's not enough advertising to do stories. So sometimes you end up with a reporter thinking it's okay to describe a conflict, and between A and B, and A says this and B says that. And what I always thought you should do is maybe if you have to write a story about the conflict and then try and figure out who's right and who's wrong. That's our job, to go beyond just the mere facts of so-and-so sues so-and-so stuff, then try and figure out if there's particularly if there's an issue involving not personal stuff, but a broader issue involved, suing over water treatment or something like that. Are the water levels safe enough? And that's the kind of stuff that you should get into. And it doesn't happen enough. I mean, we still have, even the Flint water situation, I keep on hearing contradictory things about how bad the water is. And I know that sounds silly, but it's not. It's what our business is designed to do, take time and do stories. But what you see today is, it's also harder for, when I worked at the New York Times in the heyday in the 70s, Watergate and Vietnam, sort of a free hand in that newspaper, I was actually working for the New Yorker in 71 and 72 and left it to go to the Times to write about Vietnam from Washington. Because the Times had such a reputation as a straight paper. I mean, way straight-laced. and that if I wrote a story critical of the war from Washington, it would be believed. If I was critical of Kissinger, it would be believed. And now, what you have is everybody living and dining off the tweet. Trump is high volume. Trump, people want to read about Trump. People hate him, people like him, but they want to read about him and they want to hear about him. So the cable news shows are all Trump all the time. All tweets, all of his Twitters all the time, or tweets, whatever they call them, all the time. And very little, the kind of reporting you get now is just sort of horrendous for me. I mean, I just watch it with shock.
Right. So you think the sort of point is to get to the truth?
Well, the point certainly is to write a story for the New York Times and then immediately go on two or three nightly cable shows talking about it.
Yeah.
I would have been fired if I tried to do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right. I know what you mean. Yeah.
You didn't do that. You didn't merchandise yourself that way. The story was the story, not what you did. And it's all changed, and it's sort of sad to watch. I'm an old-fashioned journalist, and it's just sad to watch that, you know, that you can write anything you want, and there's no facts anymore, you know. I mean, I've written stories galore, raising a lot of doubts about some of the things we take for that Bin Laden was killed the way he was, or that the Syrians didn't use nerve gas at the time everybody said they did. And there's no longer any debate. The media they're not interested in looking into that issue. It's all been resolved. They're bad guys, and that we go on. And, you know, nothing's that simple. But it becomes, it's reductionary, you know, and reporters don't seem to be that interested in looking at clip files or looking at the science involved. I'll give you a classic example. Everybody talks, oh my God, there was a chlorine gas attack. Well, chlorine is not a chemical weapon. It's a gas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you smell it and you walk away.
Right.
It's not a weapon.
Right.
It's never been a weapon. Chlorine gas is just not a weapon. And chlorine is all over the place in places like Syria, particularly in the opposition places, because chlorine is very good for cleaning bodies. And one thing in that society, in the Middle East, you bury right away.
Right.
And there's a lot of bombing and a lot of blood. And so people get killed. It's very messy. And chlorine is a very great cleaner. You use chlorine to clean a body and prepare it for burial. So there's chlorine everywhere. You can't bomb a house without chlorine being
right.
exposed to the gas. Anyway, it's just so much more complicated. And it's all so reductionary. And I can't, you know, I hear your question, the basic question. Where did I, you know, why do I think a little differently than other reporters, even back in 69 and 70 when I was chasing Mili? Well, like you, Mr. Poe, I'll take your word for it that you were a reader. I was a reader. I grew up in a immigrant family. My parents' basic language, they spoke to each other in Yiddish. They were from, my father was Lithuania, my mother from Poland. They emigrated here in the early 20s, very early 20s, 20, 21. And they made a living here, and they had a family in Chicago, and they all clustered together. You know, my father, I remember watching my father play soccer when I was a little boy in a park in Chicago. You know, the Lithuanians would pay the Polacks, and there'd be a lot of bloodshed then, I'll tell you that. But I remember that. It was a very ethnic world. And we weren't religious. We were Jewish, but we weren't religious. And we lived in a neighborhood that was close. My father ended up after he had made some money, he lost money, and then the stock market crash of 38. America must have been a wonderful place in the 30s because a lot of people, a lot of their friends really lived well. Anyway, he ended up running a laundry and cleaning in the heart of the Black Ghetto in Chicago on a street called Indiana Avenue, 4507. Regal Cleaners was the name of the place, and I always worked there. That was part of when I was 12, 13, I was going to work there on weekends, and customers would come with checks, and I'd go fill the order and take the money and ring it up. And I was going to help sort clothes and package them. I would do that. And so I grew up working. And my parents, it never was a question of, there wasn't any intellectual leadership. It came from within. When I was 13 or so, I think I wrote about this in the memoir. I wrote about these early days, not just briefly. And you're right. There's a tremendous amount of interest in my early days by a lot of people because nobody knows much about it because I never talk much about it. But I joined the Book of the Month Club when I was about 13, yeah. And every month I would get the nonfiction. It was $1, I think 99 cents or something like that. You send $1 off, and maybe one every 3 weeks would be by something, one every 3 months. One, it came once a month, and it would sometimes be would be some of the J. Edgar Hoover would write about the perils of communism, or John Gunther would. But 2 out of 3 weeks, months, there would be stuff on the Habsburg monarchy and Chinese civilization.
Right.
I'm reading all this stuff because I was always a little, not bored by school, but I was always good at school. And like a lot of American kids, I mean, I live for sports too, even though I, you know, my parents didn't understand sports, but I live for sports. You know, I had a twin brother, and he was also a good athlete. We used to play in all hockey in winter. Chicago was we had winters then. We live in a big apartment complex, so, you know, sort of not cold water flats, but not much better than $80 a month, I think. And I had sisters in one bathroom. And in the center of the courtyard was enough space for in winter by Thanksgiving. We had ice. We would pour water on it, and we played hockey.
Sure, sure, yeah.
And in the spring, we played baseball. In the summer, we played, you know, we played basketball. And that's what you did as kids.
That's the way I grew up.
Life.
That's exactly the way I grew
well,
up.
Well, normal life.
Yep.
And so when I'm 15, my father gets cancer, and I'm the least afraid of him. My father's, I always think of, well, how did my father communicate? There was a wonderful record Mel Brooks did called The 2,000-Year-Old Man.
Yeah.
And at one point he's asked the question, well, how did you, 2,000 years ago, how did you travel? What was the mode of transportation? And Mel Brooks said, Carl Reiner was the questioner. Mel Brooks, you know, the wonderful madcap movie maker. Mel Brooks' answer was, fear. You see a lion and run. And so I grew up less afraid of my father. He had a quick, you know, he never said much to us. And he used to shave with a strop, and a leather strop. I remember watching him sharpen it. And he used to spank us with that strop.
Yeah.
Pull down our pants and bang us. And boy, that really hurt. And so but I was least afraid. And so I could take care of him when he got sick. It went to his brain. I could take him to get a haircut. He was a dying man. And so school disappeared for me. I began working more and more in the store. You know, I began to make deliveries before I got a driver's license, because in those days, deliveries on Friday night and Saturday night were a third of the income, and you didn't report that.
Right.
That was the way it worked in lower middle class American business. So my father didn't bank. He had a safety deposit box.
Uh-huh.
He didn't have a checking account.
Wow.
Cash in, cash out. Anyway, he wasn't a thief. He just, that was the way it was. And actually, he was pretty straight about a lot of stuff. And so he's dying, and I'm supposed to get out of high school. And and there were, in my third year, I was always a straight A student, but my fourth year, everything fell apart. But I took a test, and there were three guys, me and two other guys, who ended up with the highest score. I don't think it was a straight IQ test. It was something. And the other two, one went to Harvard, and the other one went to Yale. One went to scholarship, and it came a day. Wrote me later when he got the book to say he remembered very vividly all of us. Back then, he's a now retired professor of medicine at Harvard. Anyway, the bottom line is that I never thought about college. So I barely scraped out of high school, you know, getting C's and D's, but I graduated. And that summer, never thought about it. And in the fall, I ran my father's business, and my mother was there. My brother, I had a brother who wasn't as, I was quicker. And he was too afraid of my father to even work in the store. And he ended up being a physicist, and he's fine. He went to college out of the city, and we paid for that, but that's about took most of our money. And so I ended up living at home with my mother and starting to go to a pre-junior college. What happened in Chicago after World War II, we're talking about 1952, 53, 54. After World War II, vets came back, and they wanted an education, but they had no money. So the University of Illinois set up a two-year community college called Navy Pier. It was an old pier the Navy had built in right at the beginning of the war. The train navigators, you know, ship guys who could plot ship courses. And so it was a big navigation school. They turned out 1,000 of navigators for the Navy. It was a big deal. And so a couple years after the war, the University of Illinois made a two-year community college there. They put money in refurbishing the old, it was just a wharf. And if you did well enough, you could go and get the next 2 years to go downstate and get a full degree. But it was basically just a junior college. and it was free. And the only thing I had to do was pay for a locker. We had to run a track, that was an exercise. Get a quarter mile under a minute, 55 or 50. That's hard. Let me say it's hard. Even though it's in shape, it's hard. Hated it. And so I went, what I would do is I would go and open up my father's store. This is when kids were going, you know, Harvard and Yale and University of Illinois and other schools. I went to a good high school right near the University of Chicago, Hyde Park High School. And a lot of very good public school. I don't know what it's like now, but anyway. And I would go and open the store at 7, and people would come to work. And at about 8:30, I would drive downtown. You could park right downtown in the early 50s. You could park right next to the big parking lot for students and go to school. And this was early September. And about the third week, I took a course in English. And the third, I remember the assignment. I got an assignment to compare a British novel, an American novel, modern novel, from some young, overachieving new professor. His first job, as I later learned. And I turned in a paper, and maybe the third week of school, I'm doing what kids do, you know, walking down dank halls, not connecting with anybody, just, you know, lost in space. And at the end of class, the professor called out. He said, "Is Seymour Hersh here?" And I said, "Oh, crap, what have I done?" And I walk up to the front, the young professor, and he said, "Are you Hersh?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I'll tell you." He said, "What are you doing here?" And I knew what he meant. I said, "Well, my father died and all that," because he really liked my paper. So this guy says to me, "Where do you live and what's going on?" I told him a little bit where I live, and he said he'd just gotten his doctorate at Chicago. His name was Kogan.
Bernard Kogan. I think he deserves to be mentioned. Yeah.
Yes, I read about him because he and I stayed in touch forever, but there's a connection that I'll just tell you, a hooker. And on it, that's just amazing how the mind works. And I met him at the University of Chicago a couple of days later, you know, at 9 o'clock in the morning. I cut school and I took an admissions test. At Chicago. Chicago starts late. That was a recorded system. It just barely started, but maybe late September, they were just getting organized. And they would go quarter-quarter. It would be late September to December. They were three-quarters. And so the school hadn't really started, and I was accepted right away, given money. And I placed out of a couple of history courses because I knew modern history because of those crazy books. But I didn't do that. I didn't want to be one of those kids who did the University of Chicago in 3 weeks. You know, they had these kids. And so I started there, and he saved my life in a way, and I completely forgot about this until this is literally 1983. I'm married. I've got two kids. My wife's a doc. We live in Washington in a house in Cleveland Park, and, you know, I've been at the Times. I've had my success. I'm not rich by anything else, but I'm there. I own a house, have a car, a dog, a mortgage, like everybody. And anyway, in comes mail. I'd done a book on Kissinger that provoked a lot of mail, and mail would be rooted from, some people would write the New York Times, some people would write the New Yorker, where I also worked then a little bit, and it would be forwarded to my home. And one day, my wife's opening the mail, and we'd save it, and she's going through it on the weekend, and she opens up a letter from a guy named Kogan, and it begins with, she said, "Oh my God, you better read this." She didn't know the story. It begins with, "You probably don't remember me. My name is Marshall. I always taught so-and-so, and in my 20 years of teaching, or 30 or 40, I've only interviewed twice with the students and asked them to leave where I was teaching and go someplace else. And you were one, and the other one became a neurosurgeon or something. I'm so proud of you." And I remembered, I had not thought about it. It was 25 years. I started to cry. I remembered he saved my life.
Yeah.
And ever since then, I know I said this in the memoir, ever since then, from 83 on, anybody, high school teacher, grammar school teacher, mostly high school, AP English guys or AP history, AP Vietnam guys, you know, studying. Anybody wanted me to come speak, you know, not for fee. I mean, in the area, I'd go to work tomorrow. I would go.
Yeah.
I never said no.
Yeah.
I mean, I give speeches for money a lot in universities and all that stuff, but this is different. Everybody, any local professor in Washington or Bethesda, Maryland or Virginia, you know, who wanted me to come talk, I would go even if it's an hour ride. Just go and do the class, because my God. So
Well, I should say, just to interrupt for a second, you're very gracious in the memoir. You mentioned a lot of people like Bernard Kogan who've helped you along the way. And actually, I had a Bernard Kogan in my own life who I met when I was 18. And I'm still in touch with the guy. His name's Dan Kaiser.
Lucky, still alive.
So I'm really lucky. Yeah, I'm totally really lucky. And I often tell my students, like, the most important thing that ever happened to me was that guy picked me out. And because he really did change the course of my life. And as I say, in the memoir, you mention a lot of people like this very graciously. And it's an impressive thing.
It's not graciously. It's just, you know, what's the sense of you know, what's the sense of, you know, there's always, you can always be ungracious. You can, the truth is that Kogan helped me. Later in life, there was, when I finally got a job, there was a guy at I was working in South Dakota for UPI, and my competition, a guy named Dan Perks, the AP bureau chief, in Peter, South Dakota, a little small, dinky place, and UPI, we were sort of sure, always AP had teletypists. We used to type our own stories on the teletype, you know, even on news broadcast, radio broadcast. They had, always AP was superior. Dan helped me get a job at AP in Chicago. He wrote a letter. I mean, I always think that has something to do with it, but I just don't know. And the editor at the when I worked for the, what happened is, I got through college. I was obviously a good. I always knew I could write, and everybody and my friends, they all thought I'd write the great American novel, because I was always pretty critical of people. in Chicago, in the University of Chicago, in the '50s, the real devastating word would be if you accuse somebody of not being perceptive. Chicago was a strange place. The college is small, 1,500. The graduate school is 6,000. And I ended up in a fraternity where I'd go and drink too much sometimes and play bridge. And the way you played bridge in the 50s in Chicago, every contract was a slam and challenged. And I mean, everything was an intellectual game. It was a very heady place. And I get out of there, and I wanted to get a job. Believe it or not, I learned about something called Xerox. I thought it was really going to be a big field, but I couldn't get hired by Xerox. I was an English major, and you know, and I spent the summer working in a bar selling whiskey. And in the fall, 3 weeks before the University of Chicago fall started, in early October, late September. I had played baseball, even though it was almost impossible to think about it. I managed to play varsity baseball for a couple of years. I sometimes couldn't travel with the team because I had to run the store. But on weekends, my brother would come down. He was at the University of Illinois. He would come down and run the store on Saturday so I could go play. I remember playing against the University of Wisconsin, and we played a doubleheader. Mm-hmm. Even though we were a small college, there were no NCAA rules until 60. Undergrads, in other words, for my first 2 years of being in college, graduate school students could play. So we had some tremendous athletes in med school.
Yeah, right.
And so we could play. We had a pitcher cool. That, you know, we could play Wisconsin and Harvey Keene, I remember, who was later 20 years as a professional shortstop for the Milwaukee Brewers. Was at the University of Wisconsin, their shortstop. I've never seen a better ball player. And I remember we played a doubleheader against him. And I was shocked because between the two games, he went to meet with some friends and they had a beer and smoked a cigarette. I remember being so shocked. Anyway, the upshot is I decided to go to law school. And one of my best colleagues later became dean or acting dean of the University of Chicago Law School. His father was a professor. And I went to see him on the last day of September. And I said, okay, I want to go to law school. And I got in 2 days.
Yeah.
You know, that could happen then, but I hated it. And I was a terrible student. I didn't like it. It was all memory. And so I got out of that, and I didn't know what I was doing. And one day in a bar, I bumped into a guy who worked at a place called City News Bureau, where, you know, I didn't know anything about reporting. You know, I like everybody else, I worried about Ike and the bomb and all that stuff. But I didn't know anything about it. I read the papers a little bit. The New York Times I read every day for the puzzle. You know, we'd all try to do the puzzle within 30 minutes. You know, it got harder during the week.
I have a friend that still does that.
Yeah, well, that's what I read the Times for. I grabbed the puzzle and I would look at the paper. You know, I didn't like Ike and all that stuff, but I wasn't into it. You know, and so I just tell you, I'm just trying to create some idea of how I got to where I was, because everything I did on my own. And I ran into a guy in a bar that he was flirting with a girlfriend I had gone well with, and so we were joking about it. And he just joined Time magazine, and was going to join, I don't remember which. And he was at City News, the news agency in Chicago that had been set up in 1920s in the era of Dillinger and crime and all that stuff. And there was so much crime and so much court stuff that the four major papers and the wire services and the radio stations got together and funded a news agency that would cover the courts and the police stations. And it was half the people who were hired there came from the Dill School of Journalism. The other half, all you had to need was a BA. And so what I remember vividly is going down and applying, fill out a form, and disappeared. Months later, I moved, meanwhile. The phone number I gave, no cell phones, and I gave the phone number of the apartment. And I moved, and one night about 5 months later, nobody called me back. I forgot about it. I was still selling booze in a Walgreens, still figuring out what I'm going to do. I was trying to save money. I was maybe
got a nice
travel.
Image.
I had no money. $1.50 an hour.
Yeah.
And I lived in it, but it was, you can imagine after, well, my deal with my brother was I would take care of my mother for 4 years, and then he would go to University of Illinois downstate, and he got a job in a degree in electrical engineering. He was always interested in wave theory, and he got a doctorate in physics at California. He goes to California, gets a job, and he takes my mother. That's the deal. He got married, and they set up an apartment for her. So suddenly I'm free of taking care of my mother. My brother's doing it. He honored our commitment. I did it for 4 years. And I'm living in a $12 a week room in a basement in some poor boarding room. The bathroom's down the hall with big water bugs. And I'm the happiest I've ever been in my life.
Yeah.
I'm free.
Right.
And I go to law school. I hated it. But, you know, I had a girl. It didn't matter. I had a life. I felt like I was becoming. I always read. You know, but I felt like I could get. Anyway, it was all self-starting. And so I applied for the job. And one night, I this is out of a bad movie. I went to play poker at my old apartment. I'd moved since the time I signed up at City News. I went to play poker with a bunch of guys who knew what they were doing. Table stakes, pot limit. You know, you bring $100, you lose in 10 minutes. Anyway, I was quickly wiped out. You know, I'm the worst poker player in the world. I learned that in the Army, too. I went in the Army later. And so it was about 3 o'clock by the time I got tapped out. So I went to sleep on a couch in the old apartment where I lived. There was a couch in a back room, and the phone rang in the morning. Nobody answered it, and I finally picked it up on the fifth ring, and somebody said, this is Ryberg of City News, the editor. He said, are you Hirsch? Looking for Hirsch. I said, I'm Hirsch. He said, well, your name's come up. Come on down. Let's talk about going to work.
Wow.
And that's how I got the job.
Yeah.
I mean, what was I doing there that day? You know, what karma? I go down there, and,
yeah, man, that's
and
cool.
They hire me. $35 a month, a week rather, and I become a copy boy at City News, and I fell in love.
It all could have been different. Yep.
Everything could be different, but yep. It was just amazing. I fell in love, and I had a tough editor who rode my ass hard. My name Bob.
Can I interrupt you to ask a question? Because I just found this fascinating. You were a copy boy.
You bet.
What is a copy boy? What do they do? Do they still exist?
They don't exist anymore because it's also computerized. At that time, the way it worked is we had pneumatic tubes to every station. We had a pneumatic tube, a tube that went by a power pressure tube. It went across the city to all the newspapers and all the radio stations and everybody else who subscribed. We had subscribers. You know, they would pay a certain amount for our service, and we covered every crime. And so we covered every crime, small, little, otherwise, and the editors would look at what we report and decide whether they want to send a reporter to cover it.
Yeah.
Okay, and same with fires. And so for months I was begging to get out. I didn't. And the way we did it, you called the reporters, would call in the story. You had rewrite guys who would type it up on a form that I could then attach to a machine that cranked out copies. It was like a mimeograph machine,
there
only it was
go.
A little different. It had dark blue ink. I remember I was suffused with blue ink every night. And I would put this, attach it to a little press and crank out 100 copies that we would then send, put in pneumatic tubes and send to every station. And
copy
that's
boy.
The job.
Yeah, got it.
A lot of work.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of work. And the other thing, in the morning, I worked the night shift. The last thing I had to do between 6:30 and 7 with a special soap, clean the Day City editor's desk in such a way, he was fanatic about dirt. He would come in. And his name was Larry Millay. He would come in and sit down exactly at 7 and then start running his hands over the desk. And as I wrote in my in that memoir, I mean, it was I always had fun writing this stuff. I could have won 3 Pulitzer Prizes the night before, and if I left a smear on his desk, I'd be fired.
I remember
fired
that.
Yeah. One piece of dirt.
Funny. Yeah.
So anyway, so I did that, and there was a guy named Bob Billings who had been a football player, an Illinois, big tough guy, and he's always. He was really brilliant, but he tried to hide it. He was a Joyce scholar. He taught Joyce later in life. He taught Joyce. But, you know, I knew there was something there, but he was edgy about me. I was smart, obviously. And, I had played ball, and, you know, I wasn't big. I mean, I'm 5'11". I'm bigger than I am now. You lose almost 6 feet. And I was, you know, a nice-appearing guy, and I had a lot of lip. And every day I would bring a book. And he used to ride my ass. You know, one of the things you had to do is at some point go out and get coffees. And I'd get coffees and sandwiches. And he'd come back and he'd say, "You're the dumbest fucking Jew I've ever seen. You can't get a coffee order straight. I want a cream and you got me milk." And so, but then he'd come back later. He said, "What are you reading?" He'd say. And I said, "So-and-so." He said, "What do you want to read that junk for?" He said, you know, of course, I was reading novels. I was reading, you know, Saul Bellow and. And I was reading all the novels. William Styron was beginning to write that. I was in love with these guys and copying all the words, vocabulary. And Augie Marsh had been published. It was a novel by Saul Bellow about a Chicago boy that wasn't making it. And that was me.
Yeah.
You know, I could relate to it. And so it turns out I was a good golfer, too. I picked up golf somehow. And he liked golf. And we started playing golf. And he eventually got me on the street. And so I became a street reporter in Chicago, you know, at the age of 22, 23. I was so happy. I'm covering downtown police, midnight to 8 shift, and cops are okay. You know, I'm not even a great fan of cops. Chicago cops are pretty, you know, you didn't mess around with the cops. But they, midnight, about 2 or 3 in the morning, if they scored some good Mary Jane, you know, one of the young cops would come back, and only 2 or 3 of us reporters, and we'd all share the joint, which you called marijuana back then, Mary Jane. We'd smoke a joint, and sometimes we'd look at the dirty films they'd confiscated, you know, 8mm porn. Mm-hmm. And the cops would share with us. But also, you know, one night I learned a lot being a police reporter. One night I'm in covering downtown police. I'm always on, I'm listening to radio, and there are 2 cops down about 2 miles away, and I had an old Studebaker. I get my old car, and I get out. It's winter. It's cold as hell. I get out there, and I get to the scene. And there were 2 federal postal inspectors that had been ambushed, and their car, they've been shot to death, and the car hit a pole on Roosevelt Road, about a mile south of downtown Chicago. And I'm there, I'm the only reporter there, which is good, because then my story is going to be on the desk of every newspaper, and they're going to have to sign somebody, right. Or if they want to make the first edition, you know, the last morning edition, they have to use the city news story, which happens occasionally. We like that. They tended not to want to use our stories. But, you know, they would. They'd buy city news anyway. And so I remember that looking at these 2 guys, bullets all over, blood all over, and I go up to the sergeant in charge. I have my press pass from city news. I guess these 2 of the corridor. So, you know, they had rings of cops blocking people. But I get through, and I go up to the sergeant in charge, who, of course, is in a fucking rage because a fellow cop is down. And I say, Sarge, city news, are they dead? And he looked at me and he grabbed me, and I remember I had a coat on, and he threw me as hard as you could throw anybody, the big guy, big Irish cop, against the car, parked car, and he said, not till it'll pronounce, you know, he called me any one of 6 different swear words. And so I had a big dilemma. Do I call in they're dead, or do I wait for the coroner? So I waited 15 minutes for the coroner, and he said they're dead, and I called it in. So I learned something. I learned a lot. Not so bad to wait.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks later, I'm in the South Side covering night shift, the Hyde Park district where I used to live, and I'm enjoying that. And what you do with the cops in Chicago, the Irish controlled the cops, and a lot of cops were cops because they had to be, third generation, and some of them were just amazingly brilliant. You talk about New York Times, there were guys there who did the London Times acrostic. And so you go and you make nice to the sergeant running this desk, you buy him a coffee, and then you wait around and. He'd call you and say, we got something interesting going on and so-and-so, and he'd tip you off about a fire. So I dash out to a fire in the ghetto, close to where my father's, when I graduated from college, we sold our store, the store that we hung on to, only because we were frightened peasants. We could have sold it for a reasonable, made a living, But we hung on to it, and, you know, business got slower and slower, but we ended up giving it to the employees, and they kept it going.
Yeah.
But, you know, we could have sold it, but we didn't know what else to do. We just hung on to what you have. Real ghetto people, you know what I mean? My mother could have gotten a job. I could have worked part-time. We didn't have to keep me working at the store, you know, which is it was all crazy, but that's the way it was. You didn't change. And you can understand why people, you know, didn't change before the Holocaust, because that's the way they'd done it.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, I learned something then. But when I get out to some place where there's, you know, some guy has gone nuts in the black community, shot his wife and a bunch of kids, when I get there, the fire department put the fire, started a fire, burned to death. They all burned too. And they were all wrapped up, Papa Bear, Mama Bear, and three or four little bears. And I remember being just horrified. What a story. And I, you know, the cops didn't know much about it, but a neighbor told me who they were. There'd been some domestic stuff. And I got enough so I could call in a bulletin. Remember a guy named Casey Buckwell, who later became the environmental editor of the Chicago Tribune, a wonderful, old, wonderful, great old reporter, became a wonderful reporter in Chicago. That's what we had at City News. Mike Royko, the great columnist, worked there. I used to play golf with him and drank himself to death, though. But anyway, and so I would call in this story, and I'm just horrified. You know, there's six people dead, you know, and I'm dictating this story to Casey. I think it was Casey. He used to call up and say, get me rewrite. And you just dictate it. And the Night City editor, a guy named Dornfeld, who I hated because he lived in the country and he used to wear boots to work, and he would put them all night on Larry Millay's desk.
Yeah, right.
Son of a bitch. I had to clean his boots up, you know, his cow turds and whatever it was. Anyway, he gets on the phone with me. They had a comm system, and he said, ah, my good, dear, energetic Mr. Hirsch, he said. I said, yes, sir, Mr. Dornfeld. He said that the victims, the last four victims of the, the words are literally like this, give or take a phrase, were the last four unfortunate of victims of the Negro, or were they of the Negro community, of the Negro persuasion, of Negro persuasion. I said, yes, sir. He said, cheap it out. And City News, that meant you saw what you filed is six people died in a fire in Southwest Chicago today.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a lesson in racism. I thought I knew something about racism, working, you know, growing up, working in a black community and knowing the, you know, the troubles there. I got a lesson. That was really stuck with me.
Mm-hmm.
That was, this is all in 4, 5, 6 months working. And then I had to go in the Army. I was going to be drafted and I wanted to beat the draft. So I got into a 6 month reserve. I had to go take that slot. So I know I had to leave in a couple of months, but right before I left, I saw something. The third thing, it was a great thing to learn about the persistence of racism. The third thing I saw that was just amazing as a kid reporter. And these all are the kind of things that sort of toughen you up because you see it from the inside. I was there. I mean, it happened. And one night, two cops called in. They arrested a perp. And he tried to flee, and they chased him, and they ended up at a shootout. He's dead. They were coming in, and the ambulance had taken him away, and they were going to come in and file. And it was on the radio, so I didn't wait for them to come in. I went down to the garage where I wanted to interview one of the cops before he debriefed. I wasn't suspicious. I just wanted to. That was me, you know, 4 a.m. I just went down there to, you know, and he gets in, and I'm walking towards the car. It's dark in the garage. The main police headquarters was about a 5-story building. The basement was a garage for the police cars. And he doesn't see me, and these two Irish cops, and they were Irish, you know, the Chicago cops were largely Irish, and they get out. One says, another buddy in another squad car, obviously overheard the call, and he said, hey, Mick, so the son of a bitch tried to run on you. And he said, no, he said, I told the nigger to beat it and then plug them.
Mm-hmm.
I heard it, right?
Yep.
I'm froze. I go, immediately leave. I go back, and I call the desk guy. I said, oh, my God, cops just shot a black guy. And the desk guy, doesn't matter who he is. Says, so what? I said, what do you mean? I said, I just heard a cop talk about it. He said, it's your word against his. He said, let it go. Don't touch it. Mm-hmm. I said, what are you talking about? He said, you know, you want to stay in this job? You want to stay in downtown police? You make a fuss about this, you're going to have to leave the station and maybe even leave the goddamn City News.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, come on. So I hung up and I waited a couple of days and looked at the coroner's report. The bullets were in the back. I went downtown to look at the coroner. I called that in. And so I was leaving in a couple of weeks, and I remember thinking, oh, my God, I love this profession. but it is not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
There's self-censorship really exists big time. And not only that, me too. I went along with it. There was nothing heroic about me, so I knew that going in. And you have to understand something else, which is that in Chicago, the cops just, there was a deal with the mob. You could do anything you wanted in Chicago as a cop, police reporter. If you said city news, you could park your car on the sidewalk downtown. There was a street called Rush Street, where the Giancana syndicate controlled Rush Street. There were all the bars and honky tonks. Lenny Roos used to play there, you know, in Mr. Kelly's. And if some mob guy is found in the gutter in Rush Street at 4 a.m. with 50 bullet holes in his back, and it's reported as a traffic accident, you did not screw around with it.
Yeah.
I knew that. I also knew that my period there in Chicago was exciting because I was in a tyranny too. I understood tyranny. It was a police tyranny in a way. The cops got cleaned up later. Orlando Wilson came in a couple years later. I remember writing about it when I went back to Chicago for the AP. What I did know was a tyranny. I really had a great experience as a police reporter. I understood something about how big cities work. I understood about racism. I understood about waiting an hour. I understood that it's not always an heroic business.
Uh-huh.
And these are all very important things to learn. And so they helped me. But also I understood that there was nothing more, you know, being 16, running your father's business, and it's Christmas, and it's snowing, and it's 7 o'clock at night, and you've got $700 in your pocket, and, you know, God knows what's out there in the street. You know, it's been a busy day, Christmas day, you know, everybody wants their cleaning. You do some business then. That's when we made our money in the holidays mostly. And, you know, I'm closing up, and there's gates, and, you know, anybody can come and whack me. I knew that, too.
Yeah.
Or, you know, same. So I'd gone through all that. And, you know, not that it was heroic, but I had survived all that.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to tell you, some three-star generals will come up to me and say, you know, why'd you write that story about Milan? You know, what the hell? And I would say, you know, I said it to one guy who went after me, and I said, sir, I know you got those stars, but I'm every bit of American as you are.
Yeah.
And so I always understood that. So I wasn't cowed by that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd gone through all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it's interesting you're the first person, Mr. Poe, to talk to me about the early days. But that's all formative. I was pretty much on my own. I wasn't wild. I mean, I always took care of my mother. You know, but I had time to play baseball and have a girlfriend, and we get drunk on Friday night. She would watch TV. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I do. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, she was from the old country, and she didn't know better. And when she went to California, it's interesting, she ended up getting a job working in a cleaning store, taking care of a store, and she made a living.
Yeah.
For herself, and got an apartment with a roommate. It was better for her too. Instead of hanging on to what we had.
Yeah, right.
But the instinct was when my father died to hang on. And they knew that was wrong too.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so there you are.
Well, I guess what I was going to say is that, you know, your tenaciousness and actually also your inventiveness was even apparent at this moment because you're always doing things on the side. And you might talk a little bit about that. It wasn't just.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the thing about it was you weren't just doing what you were told. You were also investigating other things. And this happens after you go into the Army. And then when you start, you know, for example, you started a newspaper, Evergreen Oakland Dispatch. You're an ambitious guy. Yeah. I mean, this kind of.
I went to the Army and I did my 6 months. I learned to shoot a gun. I learned I could take apart a machine gun, I guess, blindfolded and all that stuff. And I learned a lot in the Army. I was in a basic training unit, and in the Ozarks, it was very hot. And the thing you waited for the most is after 5 weeks, you could have a Friday night off, and you could do two things. You could get to a motel and take a shower by yourself and go to the bathroom by yourself.
Yeah, right.
You could also buy, outside the gates, all the local farmers were selling, you know, their local hooch.
Yeah.
Corn whiskey, you know, and so you could get, you know, stoned, blind, drunk on cheap whiskey that you're buying for the farmers.
Right.
And feel like a human being again a little bit. Anyway, but I actually, the irony is that basic training, I'll tell you what the Army is, the conundrum of the Army. I was at a big base, Fort Leonard Wood. They had a baseball team, a division. It was a division team in those days. It was pre-Vietnam. The Korean War was over, and the big thing was Division One would play division. The first division would play the second division. Yeah. The general in charge was always wondering. And they had a baseball team, and they had tryouts for baseball. And I made the team in basic training, which made no sense because I was going to be shipped out after basic training to another place. You know what I mean? It was 10 weeks or so of basic training. And so in the fifth week, I made the team. And so I would go practice with the team every day in the afternoon. And my other guys didn't like me very much because I'd go back on the chow truck instead of marching back 20 miles, 10 miles. And by the time they came back, I was, dead asleep, exhausted from kicking up ground balls, as I say, or whatever. And then after another 5 weeks, I was shipped out to another base. So I never got to play. So why would the Army let somebody in basic training make the team when there was no way he was going to? I began to figure out the Army.
Well, it's funny you mentioned this because my father was in the Army, and he would be about your age if he were alive. And he never really spoke very well of the Army. I mean, even as someone who made it, he was a captain when he retired. But he was, for him, the Army was a situation normal, all fucked up. It's changed very much today. People don't think of the Army that way anymore.
No,
but he did.
Professional Army now. Then it was volunteers, and it was just... You just did it. I did it. It was a good learning experience. I had been such a cloistered life. I was now living with a bunch of guys. There were guys there from the Deep South. There were some Cajuns from Louisiana who wouldn't take showers. We'd have to give them what they called GI showers. We have to pull them out of there. They come in from the field. We'd come in, it was August, and you're in basic training. You'd come in, and you'd just go into the shower and strip in the shower. And wash with soap as you took off each piece of clothing, your shirt, your pants, your socks, your underwear, and wash them there and just try and get clean and then hang them out. There was hangers outside. They dry in an hour, so hot and warm. And these guys wouldn't shower. So we'd have to, every 2 days, have to grab them and force them to have showers, and they'd all be talking about coming back later in life with their big brother and knife us to death. They were going to kill us all. They spoke Cajun. So I saw all sorts of different people. And I learned to watch my mouth. I'm a bit of a smart ass, but I could always do 50, 50 push-ups or something.
Yeah,
I was always
both.
In good shape.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I got through that. And then I came back and I looked for a job. I'd been working at City News. And City News, I did a terrible thing at City News. When I left, I insulted the sports editor. And he said when I came back, everybody who went in the Army got a job back at City News. He would quit if I came back. There's in the City News is if you're on a beat, and if I, let's say, I'm covering Central Police and I miss something, it's in the papers and I hadn't reported it, I get a demerit. There was a scoop sheet. And on Friday nights, the sports editor used to drag me to take basketball scores. I spent 2 hours taking 800 basketball scores from downstate and everywhere. I hated it. And because I hated it the most and was most vocal about it, he made me do it. And so the last day I was there, I went and bought all the British papers, and I took out about 50 clips of football, soccer, football,
yeah,
and look, not and what are the other Australian football,
yep.
and the other game where they bowl the ball, what's a cricket,
mm-hmm.
And I took 20 stories and I clipped them up and I scooped them on 20 stories from Europe. So when he came in that morning, it was a scoop sheet all full of him.
Yeah.
And he was so mad at me, I couldn't get back. So I finally got a job at a local newspaper in the South Side of Chicago. And so I finally did that. And it turned out the paper was a shill. It was owned by a bigger newspaper in the area who wanted to make sure no competition came in. It was a terrible newspaper, but I was the only reporter and editor. So I could report City Hall at a place called Evergreen Park, Oaklawn, a suburb of Chicago. Kaczynski, the Mad Bomber, out of Evergreen Park.
Yeah.
I can understand why. But anyway, no, it's okay. But the point is that I learned how to do offset, write stories, edit them. And then Billings, the fellow from City News, where I used to play golf with, I had some money, and he said, why don't we start a real newspaper here? I've got money. Quit that place. And I did. And I started a paper with Billings, and it was a great paper. We started a paper. Mike Royko used to write for it. Other guys at City News would come and write for it. We really covered the city. We're critical. We had about 15,000-18,000 subscribers. Just deliver. We drop off papers to kids. We had in two suburbs.
Yeah.
But we gave them news, and within about a month or two, we began to get national advertising for cars and other things. And so this started in the spring. And by the summer, we had one ad that it was going, and it was a good paper. But my God, I didn't want to be the publisher of a paper. I was selling ads.
Right. Well, I wanted to comment about that because that is part of the most entertaining. I think an entertaining part of the memoir is the passages where you describe selling ads, because it's really look, you got to make the business run. I mean, those people they bring in the money.
we would print about 18,000 copies, and we had a truck that would go print. And if I didn't give them, it was about $600 cash. If I didn't have $600 every Wednesday night to pick up those copies, the kid who picked up the copies and dropped them off, and sometimes if he was sick, I would do it. You know, we had a truck we rented and drop off the papers. And so we had a guy named Baker who gave us a promise, a full page ad every day. And if he wanted to, I probably would have put it on page one if he paid enough.
Some publications do that now. So you were ahead of your time.
I just understood being a publisher. I was, we had four people work for us. One was one old friend from Chicago that helped sell ads, and we had other people writing stories. You know, Mike Royko came and wrote some stories about Evergreen Park and suburbs, and so in the book is a photograph of me and Billings and a guy named Paul Zimbrakis, another guy from City News would come and help us our first edition. And that was the headline in the first edition, our founding edition. You know, we were so full of ourselves.
Yeah.
But we did something. The first edition had to come over Christmas.
Yeah.
And they over early in the year when schools were just turning over, and I had a wonderful friend who was a great photographer, and we turned them loose on kindergarten. And the first day of kindergarten, kids walking with their mother and fathers and being nervous and being in class, my friend Ronnie Goldberg was a great photographer. We took 100 pictures, and we made sure somebody went with him, got the names of everybody. And the first edition, in the centerfold, it was a tabloid, but in the middle of the page, maybe it was a 26-page or 28-page, in the middle of the 14-15 spread, two whole pages of kids starting kindergarten with the name of the kid and his mother there or his grandmother.
Yeah.
And that was a way to start. I mean, we knew how to do it.
Yeah, that was that.
But
I
woke up one day in the summer, and I said, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
And I told Billings, I got to go. I couldn't do this. I didn't want to do it. I want to be in the world. And he got mad because I was the driving force.
Yep.
And I left. And he folded the paper. He was silly. Mm. He could have kept it going. He waited a couple of weeks. He was mad at me forever.
Yeah.
But I went to California, played golf for a little while, tried to get a job in the LA Times, couldn't get one, and came back. And by sheer luck, I called up somebody at UPI, a guy named Gene Gillette, who was a lovely man. He was the regional editor, and I went to see him. And I don't know, my guess is somebody at City News did some good things to me, because at that point my track record was I flunked out of law school.
No, it's true.
A newspaper that I quit.
Yeah, right.
I left the newspaper in the middle of it.
Doesn't look good.
I've been fired by City News, the only guy that couldn't come back to City News.
Yeah.
And so what record did I have? But I went to see him, and he hired me to work as a number two guy in a bureau in South Dakota.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I know we've taken up a lot of your time, and I want to get in a couple more questions, if that's okay.
Okay.
These are just a few more. And so one of them is about we're going to skip a little bit, and when you actually make it to D.C. and you start to work in the Pentagon and talk to people at the Pentagon, you have some very interesting and revealing things to say about the press corps at that time. I mean, I don't want to characterize it for you, but it just seems like they were in the pocket of the military.
Well, you know what I did in that, because I got to cover the Pentagon. What happened is I worked at UPI and did fine, and AP hired me in Chicago.
Yeah.
And in Chicago, I had a ball. And the great thing, the city editor there couldn't have been more different than I. He's a wonderful city editor. He was a very devout Catholic and a brilliant, brilliant guy. And he disagreed with me on things, but he really did appreciate my abilities. And so I eventually was given the job of going to work at 5 in the afternoon or 4 in the afternoon doing the night shift. And I didn't have to sit at a desk. I did things like I got to Chicago for the AP, and I was assigned to do radio, write the radio wire. You know, the way it works is that the national wire the AP has for all the radio stations, including the network. And there's about twice a day for about 8-10 minutes and a half hour and the hour, there would be a local split. I would then, as a radio guy, I would then I didn't have to type it like I did at UPI. We had a typist. I would then write copy for the radio for 5 minute splits twice a day. Right. You know, twice an hour, and that was a job. And I would sometimes change things and juice it up a little bit. And they eventually, I had a little flash, and they eventually put me on the desk where I was night reporting. We could rewrite anything in the Chicago papers, and I'd like to get out, but sometimes I would just be, I would do things like I wrote about this. The Lincoln Park Zoo had a famous gorilla named Sinbad, and one night he got out. He got loose. Somebody left the door open, and instead of running through crazy, he went right into the dining hall where he glommed down and threw right. and also had a beer, opened up some beer, and smashed some cans, and it was a big spread in the paper. And so we then had to write a wire story about it, pick it up. And most guys would just write, we could make it AP. We didn't have to say Chicago. We had the copyright to the Chicago Daily News and the Tribune, the four papers subscribed to us. And we had the right to take their stories and rewrite them as AP stories. That's say the Sun-Times said today. They just say, you know, just use their material. And so I took it and I remember the Sinbad. I said, Sinbad, something like Sinbad the Gorilla, was nursing a hangover, just like any other guy that had a night on the town.
Yeah.
Right? And so that story would go on the wire, and all of a sudden, I did stuff like that, two or three pieces like that, and it was getting tremendous play. I'd be off lead in the Herald Tribune in Chicago, and New York, rather. People would like those, you know, 500-word little feature on page one. And the guy that ran the night wire sent a message, who's writing this stuff? And they said, well, a kid named Hirsch. He said, put his name on the story.
Yeah.
And then he said, eventually he said, let this guy go. And my job was to write a story every day. Let's go to, and for about 6-8 months I did it. And finally, they promoted me to Washington. And I learned later that Carol Ehrman, the Day City editor, who, you know, wasn't a big, you know, he was much more conservative than I was. He's the one who pushed me to go to New York, to Washington. He wrote a letter of recommendation saying this kid's got it. And so I was in Washington for a little while. I got sent to the Pentagon. But I had been reading about the war incessantly since 62. I find the New York Times every day, reading Neil Sheehan, David Halberstam. Sheehan was UPI, Mel Brown was AP, Halberstam was New York Times. There were other guys at the New York Times, wonderful correspondents who were there even before David, who was skeptical about the war, and then they began to read Bernard Fall. So when I get to the Pentagon, I'm already knowing. I also read the various Christian, not the Catholic Church, but Protestant Church, had put out book pamphlets describing the perils of the war and collecting all the negative stories around the world, because a lot of foreign press were reporting bad stuff that we weren't,
right,
about the killing and murder that was going on. I also read the Russell Tribune, which had some great stuff in it. So when I got to the Pentagon, I began to talk to officers, junior officers that come back. You know, the Pentagon's full of the bright. They go and do 6 months or a year in Vietnam, and they come back, and they be on some aid to a senior general. But they go have lunch like anybody else, and I just sit down with a guy and say, I'm a kid reporter here from Washington, you know, the AP, what's it like? And let me tell you what I thought about the war. I got to know people, you know, and I had information. And so there were, you'd find smart guys, and they eventually began to say how screwed up the war was and how murderous it was and how awful it was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I learned a lot. And I got in trouble in the Pentagon, and I couldn't believe how sublime the press corps was.
Yeah, this is the part I'm interested in right here, which I just
What I did in the book is Len Downey, who was a young reporter then for the Chicago, for the Washington Post, later became the managing executive editor. Len Downey and I met the first day I started with the first day he started. So Len, 20 years later, writes a book about investigative reporting with a chapter on me, and he described how he saw the Pentagon press office, which is the same way I did.
Uh-huh.
So I used his description. They would just sit there. The way it worked in the Pentagon in those days, if you saw a general or an admiral for a story, you had to sign in. That meant if you had a story that was critical and some admiral helped you, you had to spend 2 or 3 days talking to 6 or 7 other admirals and generals to muddy them. They were keeping track of us.
Uh-huh.
So the reporters didn't fight that system. And every day you had a briefing. Some general would give a briefing, and they'd report the briefing and write a story about it. And I couldn't believe what was going on.
Yeah.
So I just didn't do that.
Yeah.
I did my own thing. I got in a lot of trouble. McNamara wanted to fire me. They were all against me. But I began to report good stuff. And I write about how, of all people, Neil Sheehan came back from the war to cover the Pentagon for the New York Times. And he and I became friends because he was a great reporter. He couldn't understand what was going on, too. And twice I wrote stories that they were lying about bombing of North Vietnam. And twice I was going to get fired. But Neil Sheehan took my story and told the New York Times to run it on page one. And they did with the AP byline. That never happened.
Yeah.
Neil did that twice to me. And he kept me in, kept my job. So we stayed friends all of our lives.
Yeah, I just found that just pretty, supine is a good word for it. I just found it kind of remarkable at the time.
Well, I found it was, but that's the way it was. Then the war was, it was there. The My Lai was there to be reported. So when I learned 2 years later, I get the tip, I knew it was true. I knew there was something like this had to happen.
Yeah.
I didn't know how bad it was when I started.
Right.
There you go.
Thank you very much for your time, Sy. I really, really appreciate it. You've taken up an hour with us. That's just very generous of you.
Well, I was intrigued by your book.
Thank you. Goodbye, my friend. All right. Take care. Bye-bye.